Welcome, welcome, welcome. Man, part two. You enjoyed part one, right? I did. This is part two. I don't need to say too much. Speechdevelopmentrecords.com. I've already plugged you for that. I'm not going to push hard on the merch. I'm not going to push you on this. In fact, instead, I'm going to push you towards Tom's record. Go and buy his new record. I'm going to push you hard towards that instead. Yeah, this had to be a two-parter. It was amazing. Two of the most popular podcasts we've had, the Eddie Temple Morris episode and the Gail Porter episode, because we got open and honest and dark. And in this one, actually, there was a couple of things I considered asking to have edited out. I didn't in the end, but I send these over to Wargie, who does an amazing job of mastering them. And there was a couple of things I said that I kind of felt that played on my mind afterwards, because I felt they were a bit too honest or open or giving too much to you people. But I decided against it, because I decided that's the nature of the podcast. And the fact is, I've had other people come on here and be insanely open. So it'd be wrong of me to do anything otherwise. Anyway, let's get into this. This is part two of the Tom Robinson episode, episode 64 of the Distraction Pieces podcast. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Well, let's continue with part two now. So, yeah, we've covered so much in the first half, and we were just at the point of essentially of the band's splitting. And again, that's these things with personal clashes or differences happen. How was it for you, and what was your mindset then? What were you going to do? Do you start a new band? It's tough when the band that split is the Tom Robinson band. And again, you'd said the mistake of the name. It's tough when the band that split is you, because then what do you do? Just start a new band? Do you perform as Tom Robinson and not the band? Or, you know, it's a tough one.
I'd painted myself into a corner there, yeah, to be honest. But also, you must know this yourself, that you just lose perspective of what is real, what is true. The whole life that you've lived up to that point has vanished forever.
Yeah, yeah.
You're never going to be the same person or in the same circumstances. So we'd signed to EMI Records at a time when we had Pink Floyd's manager looking after us, negotiating deals. I was suddenly getting like 20,000 quid into the bank account. And in 1978, that was a ridiculous amount,
yeah,
of money, you know.
Yeah, sure.
I had no idea what money was worth anymore. I'd been signing on up until 2468 got into the charts,
yeah,
and my one treat was a McDonald's small hamburger once a week when I went to sign on, because that's all I could afford,
yeah,
over and above basic rent and you know, rice,
so, yeah,
noodles.
Big changes.
And suddenly, you know, a friend would say, can you lend us 1,000 quid? Yeah, all right. Get out a checkbook and write them a check.
It's also interesting because you don't learn. I mean, I was quite lucky because I didn't have any break in any of this until about 25, 26, and I felt grown up enough to go, right. Because again, the main thing that no one tells you is this isn't the kind of job that's a sturdy long-term career. So every time I've had a year where I've made a ton of money, I've been like, wow, we're making loads of money. It's been a realisation of, is this a load of money if it's 3 years' wages or if it's 4 years' wages? Because if I now need some time off, like, as I'm doing at the moment, if I need some time off to write new material, to not be touring, to re-find everything, that's time off from earning money and putting money in the bank. And it's easy to have that, oh, I'm bringing money in, I'll lend all my mates some money, I'll do this, I'll do that. What happens in a year or two when that, as you experience, when that potentially all goes out the window?
Exactly. And then your personal relationships also kind of tend to become dodgy.
Yeah.
Because after we'd had the first hit, I went back to the gay pub in North London where I used to go and hang out every Friday night. There was a Gay Liberation Front disco there.
Yeah.
And so I thought I'd go back and touch base with my old roots.
Yeah.
And when I walked in, like, people were almost evenly divided. There were people who had never had much time for me, were going, oh, well, I always knew you'd make it. Lovely to see you, Tom. Yeah, can I buy you a drink?
Yeah,
great,
yeah,
stuff,
yeah,
man. Oh, you're so great.
Yeah.
And others were going, oh, So we've come back slumming, have we now?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
to
yeah, yeah.
You know, see how the other half live.
Yeah.
You know, you think you're so great. Who do you think you are walking in here? Are you expecting us all to ask for your autograph now?
Yeah.
And so I hadn't changed yet.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
you eventually
do.
But I hadn't changed. I was the same person walking in, but the reactions were all
completely.
Other people's perceptions had altered.
It's similar to the thing I feel. I feel the whole difficult second album thing is a myth. I think the fact is your first album, no one has to listen to it. The people are listening to it because they've chosen to. Whereas your second one, you've often got a name. Therefore, people who wouldn't have listened to having to review it, or having to be involved. And it's a similar thing there. You'd been in that pub previously. No one had to have an opinion on you.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now, everyone has to. And some of them aren't going to be good as some of them are. But they need to have an opinion on you because things have changed.
Yeah.
You know, whereas before, as I said, you could just be the people who know you or choose to know you are the only ones that have to care about your appearance
and
there.
And the other thing that I touched on earlier, which is, you know, spending all that time replying to fan mail instead of writing bloody songs.
Yeah.
You know, you're a songwriter. You have to write songs.
Do you think any part of that was down to your previously realised loneliness, that need to be liked, to respond to every letter, because I don't want them to think I'm a nasty person. And in reality, it's, as you said, they probably wouldn't have, or probably weren't expecting a response. But that almost over need to make everyone go, oh, isn't he nice? Isn't he a nice boy?
Being too eager to please.
Yeah, yeah. Rather than that, right, here's what my actual job is. At the end of the day, again, the more people that do know of you, the less you can make sure everyone knows you properly or loves you or whatever else. You're broadening that fan base there.
Yeah. I mean, bizarrely, I'd had this chronic determination to become famous because I wanted to be lovable and I wanted to, quite frankly, get laid.
Yeah.
You know, I had no confidence in the London cruising scene whatsoever.
Yeah.
You know, so I kind of hoped that people would find me more attractive if I had been on a stage and was poncing about with a guitar.
Yeah.
So, yes, I did get more laid, but I never knew who it was they thought they were sleeping with.
Yeah.
Because you knew that somebody was going to go brag, I just had him.
Yeah.
You know, it was just for a brag or a dare.
Yeah.
They didn't give a toss about me.
No.
And the very best experience from that whole late 70s thing I can remember was I went back to my stay with my parents up in County Durham, where the family there were. And I went out to a nightclub in Newcastle, and there was this really attractive boy in his late teens, 19, 20, something like that, dancing on his own on the dance floor. And I went and danced with him, and we hit it off.
Yeah.
And I bought him a drink. He took me back to his flat. We had a wonderful night, just gentle and tender and pleasant and affectionate. And in the morning, he said, "So, what do you say your name was?"
Yeah, it's perfect.
And he had no idea what I did for a living or who I was out there in the world. He didn't know what I did.
And again, that must have been hugely rewarding for you, because the you as a teen, as the nervous, awkward teen, is who pulled that night, essentially. Not Tom Robinson on stage. Not the Tom Robinson you tried to escape by becoming that person on stage was the one that went out there and pulled this handsome young man, you know?
Yeah, that was just so rewarding, so gratifying, so enormously touching to have been liked for my own sake. And we spent a weekend together up there and sharing time, going up for meals, doing things. And he came to see me off on the train and cried on the platform. And it was just...
Wow.
In a time of turbulence and uncertainty, the band breaking up, horrible reviews in the press, managers pressurising you to go to America, what are you going to do next? Publishers saying when we're going to have some new songs, agents saying you need to go and do some gigs in Japan, and all this stuff.
That kind
this
of
little episode.
Real life, personal a reaffirmation of your worth.
As a human being.
As a human being, hugely important. Because again, it's tough at times like that because there's going to be a level of people who are telling you how great you are, who you don't really, you can't necessarily trust. There's going to be a level of people telling you how awful you are, who again, you can't necessarily trust, you know. So to have that moment of purity in that way of this is just me, then that must have been, yeah, I can understand. That must have meant the world.
So, yeah. Now, you said that thing of how much, this is a large amount of money for this year, but if you spread it over 3 years, how much is that worth? Yep. Well, the tax people sort of did that.
Yeah.
Because we got a lot of money from the first album. We spent most of it making the second album.
Yeah.
We didn't make very much money from the second album, and I invested everything I'd made from that into a band called Sector 27, which didn't sell any copies at all. And then the tax man came knocking and said, you know, all that money you had, where's our bit?
Yeah.
And at that point, I had nothing.
Yeah.
My management company, I'd by then left Steve O'Rourke and Tony Howard, the Pink Floyd managers. The new managers I'd gone to had gone bankrupt. The accountants who were meant to be looking after me hadn't actually kept proper records for the last 6 years. We'd been paying them a fortune, but they hadn't kept proper books.
That's outrageous.
And there was nothing to be done.
Yeah.
But forgive me for telling you an anecdote that I've told a million times before, but your listeners might not know this.
This is just
a great little moment like the one we just discussed. I had to sell off everything. Okay. I had to sell everything that wasn't nailed down just to even kind of pay the short-term debts, let alone the sort of 80,000 quid owing in VAT and so I was selling off the last of the TRB flight cases and bits of equipment out of my garage. And these two guys in combat fatigues with long dreadlocks and kind of Barbadian accents came to look over the stuff, kind of looking it over rather disdainfully and kissing their teeth. And one of them looked at the TRB logo on the side of the one of the flight cases and said, Tom Robinson said, what happened to him?
Wow.
And I said, well, actually, I am Tom Robinson. Yeah. And this guy said, you know, divest yourself of all this. You don't need this. You'll come back. And when you do, you'll be able to buy whatever you need then. You know, you don't need all this shit. You'll come back. Don't you worry. I said, well, sure, look at Eddie Grant. He said, I am Eddie Grant.
That's perfect.
I mean, I've dined out on that story 1,000 times, but it still makes
amazing.
Me chuckle, even though it really happened.
That's
sometimes,
beautiful.
Sometimes I think I made it up, but no, it did actually happen.
It reminds me a little bit, and again, I've told it's not my own story, but there's a podcast I like called The Nerdist, and Tom Hanks was on that, and obviously amazing. Everyone loves Tom Hanks. You can't not love Tom. And he was saying, when they were asking of how do you keep things in check when, you know, they were talking of his year where he had big and like huge film after huge film, and he said he realised quite early on, you know, you wake up one day and all of a sudden you're MC Hammer. You know, it's the world's crazy. You're MC Hammer, but what you've got to remember is next year, you could be MC Hammer. And again, it's just the perfect summation of realizing the ups and downs of the entertainment industry, I guess. So
true. Well,
so you had to get rid of everything. And again, just a little a tip to bands here. Again, we were lucky early on that we got a good accountant who made a business account and took, you know, so you're only paying your business tax or whatever, and then we take a yearly wage and things like that, so it's spread out over years, right? Because again, it's an industry where you could earn a shitload 1 year and not much the next year, but still you'll have to pay the tax on that huge amount, which isn't fair if it's spread out over numerous years. The tax man doesn't then go, oh, you didn't earn much next year, so have some of this back. That's not, so again, the way I guess people seem to counter that now is that having the business account and spreading it out and paying dividends and small amounts and avoiding being stung in that way and looking at that security. But so many people, particularly at that point, as the record industry was kind of having its first few big booms, that first moment of, wow, this is never ending. Mm. This is this will carry on forever. No, not so much.
Not so much.
Yeah.
We were talking when you came in 2010 to talk on my Six Music show. Yeah. We talked about Billy Bragg a bit.
Yes.
Now, he did it a really interesting way because he came very grassroots, playing anywhere that would have him. His first album, again, he recorded for 90 quid, 70 quid, I think.
And he was one, as you were saying about Joe Strummer watching the Pistols, I remember hearing Billy tell stories of how he went and saw the Clash at a rally and was like, this is what I need to do. This is it. So,
absolutely. And his first album, he just recorded it straight to stereo with him and his electric guitar, 70 quid to record it, on the basis that if your record costs nothing to make, every single copy sold is profit. And he had Peter Jenner managing him, who instigated that. Yeah. And the other thing that Jenner did for him is he paid him 50 quid a week. Billy only drew 50 quid a week all through that early period of success and put the rest in a deposit account.
Yeah.
And all the money he was earning, he never saw it, he never touched it. He still wore the same jeans, caught the same buses. He refused to be touched by it. He kept himself on a low wage, living the same old Billy Bragg life.
It's bizarre because not even knowing that, again, when me and Dan first came up and had all this exposure and all this, we started to pay ourselves a monthly wage that was a fraction more than I was earning at HMV. And that's what we paid for this time. And again, it's tough because your mates will see merch flying out or gigs selling out and assume you're rolling in money. It's like, I'm skint this month because I've spent my small amount I pay myself each month. So it's the wise way to do it, I guess. And but it's not that easy, and not everyone hears that at the time. So what kind of came after that?
I had to flee the country.
Why?
Packed all my remaining possessions, basically my four track cassette Porter Studio, a guitar.
Yeah.
Roland Space Echo into the back of an Austin A40, which I'd bought for 30 quid, drove it on the ferry to Hamburg and went and lived in Hamburg on a friend's floor for six months.
Wow.
Because, like I say, if you owe 80,000 quid in VAT, that's not Her Majesty's Inspector of Revenues, that's customs and excise.
Yeah.
And they have extraordinary powers, literally they're called extraordinary powers, to levy distress on your goods and chattels, which means the customs could have turned up at my front door with a warrant and seized the house.
Yeah.
So I had this little two up, two down flat, a Muse flat in Hammersmith that would later have a studio downstairs and two rooms upstairs to live in.
Yeah.
And because I was desperate to keep that as my one bit of security, and even that wouldn't have paid the debts, it was only worth 20 grand at the time, I fled the country, so they couldn't serve the order on me.
Wow. Again, that must have been insane to go from the lavishness of celebrity to literally fleeing the country. Yeah. You know, that's a huge hill to fall down, I guess, in that way.
Yeah.
So what did you do when you found yourself out there?
While I was in Hamburg, I made an album on 8-track called North by Northwest, which kind of got me back in the game and got some decent reviews. And I, most notably, I was staying with a friend there who was a record company promotion man, and I'd met him while on EMI.
Yeah.
So he put me up, refused to take any rent.
Amazing.
and everything, and gave me a spare room. And after dinner one night, I had a kind of transcendent psychedelic experience on this spliff, which I was completely off my tits. I mean, more than I'd ever been.
Yeah.
And I climbed into the Austin A40 and drove it wildly in that state across Hamburg to the gay sauna on the far side of town.
Right.
Spent an evening there, then somehow, still completely high, drove the car back, stumbled into my bedroom, sat down with a pen and paper and wrote 8 pages of scribble, which began with the words, "Only the very young and the very beautiful can be so aloof, hanging out with the boys, all swagger and poise." And that stream of consciousness ramble just came from a place I have no idea where emotionally, yeah. but it was the cumulative effect of severe drugs yeah. and a traumatic night in a gay, yeah. gay sauna being rejected.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, whatever that isn't going to be my next single.
Yeah, surely not.
but it wouldn't go away, that ramble. I kept coming back to those words, trying to make them scan and rhyme and yeah. turn them into something. In the end, I arrived, in short, with a song called War Baby, which I touted round my German record company, dropped me because of that record.
Wow.
Saying it's hardly another 2468 motivate, Tom.
Yeah.
They signed the paper letting me out on the day it entered the UK charts.
Amazing.
So, and all the UK record companies turned it down, but we put it out on an independent label. It got to number 6 and then promptly stalled because we ran out of stock.
Yeah.
You know, running your own record company, you had no idea about this stuff.
There's only so much that can be...
I know.
So it's amazing.
But anyway, all the record companies called up within 3 or 4 days going, always knew you'd do it, Tom.
Always knew you'd come back.
Yeah. Do you fancy dinner?
Yeah.
We must do lunch.
Yeah.
All that nonsense. But on the back of that, while War Baby was still in the chart, I was invited around to Virgin Records to have a chat with... I think Simon Draper, some of the people there anyway, and they were having their international conference that morning,
right.
and I was introduced, they played the record, and all these international representatives, the Swedish guy said, this is a great single, we have a great TV show, we can get you on that one if you want to come out next Tuesday, we can put you onto that, and the German guy was saying, oh yes, and then you could come down to Munich, and we also have a very important Radio Life programme, you can put a band together and play on that tomorrow, at the end of next week, and I went away, and I went home, and I thought, do I actually want to get back on that carousel of all the stuff that drove me mad, led to pretty much another nervous breakdown and financial ruin?
Yeah.
Or do I want to have a nice life? And I never called them back.
Amazing.
And I had a chance to sign to Virgin Records, but it would have meant going back into the fray and all that kind of promotional rock and roll nonsense.
And in such a similar way of you essentially, and I'm sure there was loads of other goods, but they were doing this essentially because of one song.
Yeah.
And having, as you said there, people always comparing everything to 2468 Motorway, where after that is like, well, this is happening again. We're going to go on TV and everything. I've just written one song here. There wasn't an album, what's next? Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So you walked away from it at that point.
And I've skipped over the nervous breakdown because at 30, when the tax people started coming around and the reviews had got really bad, and this personal isolation had got really bad, I had got to the stage where I was leaving the door locked at the flat and staying indoors for 3 or 4 days at a time, not answering the phone, and going to the doctor and complaining about fictitious back pain so as to get soluble distal G6 to stockpile in my cupboard after a friend had successfully topped himself using those. Yeah.
I mean, the therapeutic benefits of being of getting in the public eye and receiving praise for someone that's previously felt lonely, previously felt worthless is huge. But then when that turns around and you're in the public eye and you're receiving heightened
hate
or even just indifference, it's all the louder, I'd imagine, and all the more painful and dangerous.
Very much so. I totally agree with that. And so I really was on course for a second and perhaps successful suicide attempt at that point. And every now and again, I'd kind of pull back from the brink and I'd sort of go out and socialise and things would get better for a bit. And then I'd get another night when it all got really dark. And I realised that sooner or later, those pills in the cupboard were going to get used.
Yeah.
And then I happened to read the Joe Orton biography, Prick Up Your Ears.
Right.
John Lahr wrote that.
Yeah.
And the thing that struck me immediately reading it was that it was clear that Kenneth Halliwell, his lover, was going to kill Joe Wharton.
Right.
That's what happened. He murdered him and then killed himself. That
wow. Yeah,
it
yeah,
was
yeah.
prefigured at least 5 years before it happened. They even wrote a play together about two lovers where one of them gets jealous of the other and kills him.
Wow.
You know, it was that clear. And in his diaries, Joe Wharton kept writing, I must leave Kenneth. I really must. He's not good for me.
Yeah.
And yet he didn't.
Yeah.
So he just let it slide, even though it's coming up on the horizon, it was looming, it was obvious what was coming. And it couldn't have been more obvious what was coming for me at that point.
Yeah.
And at that point, I just put the book down, flushed all the drugs.
I was going to say, the fact that you're stockpiling, the fact that you're preparing, I think on all these things, there's so many points along most journeys where you can make a choice to step away from this. And again, I'm not only talking about a depression here. It's always annoyed me when people will say, "Oh, I cheated. I was drunk." It's like, but you started the night at home, and then you went out somewhere on your own and got drunk and surrounded yourself with people where there could be potential temptations. Like, there's so many points along that route where you can step away from that. It's a similar thing there. If you're aware that you're depression is getting stronger. It's an interesting one because I think it's such a confusing thing because I've had this numerous times and never quite been able to understand it or get my head around it. But the a crippling loneliness, only overpowered by the complete lack of desire to socialise with anyone at all. So do you know what I mean? Having that, you're feeling so alone. But I really, if someone rang me up and said, "Oh, we're going to the pub," I'd be like, I don't really fancy that, actually. I mean, such a weird paradox in many ways that you're feeling that need to socialise more, but also don't particularly fancy it kind of thing. So it's a weird thing. So it must have been a huge deal to then to be reading this and see something so obvious on the cards and realise that in your own life and go, right, I need to step away from this, the hole I'm burying myself in at the moment.
Yeah, and I did pick up the phone. I called my manager. I said, "Colin, for fuck's sake, find me a shrink."
Right. Yeah.
I don't care what discipline. I don't care what school of therapy.
Yeah.
Whatever it is, I'm going to take it and I'm going to follow it. I'm going to see it through. And in 1980, at the age of 30, I started seeing a therapist for kind of basically Freudian-based psychotherapy, but with modern twist. Up in Crouch End once or twice a week.
Yeah.
And I kept it up for 10 years.
Yeah.
And from age 30 to age 40, I was in therapy, and it saved my life again. In the same way that Mr. Lyrewood and Finchley Manor had saved it in my teens, in my 30s, I was brought from a situation where at age 30, I couldn't even form a relationship with a cat.
Yeah, yeah.
At age 40, my first child was born.
Amazing.
And that was the journey that I made in terms of emotional readiness to engage
again,
with the wider world.
Just hearing all of this story so far, it's so clear to anyone listening that these might not be scenarios and things that you can handle on your own, yet it would have taken you so long to realise it's acceptable to need help, to need guidance, to need therapy, to need someone to help you along here. And it's such a bizarre thing with our society. And again, I mention it all the time, but it never used to be that way. You used to have shaman or elders or people in general who would give you guidance and help. That's something we seem to have lost as we've evolved in a more broad society, but we've not really replaced. We've lost the idea of a shaman or the elders, but we've not really gone, well, what was their actual function? It was maybe to give guidance, maybe to help people who kind of feel a bit lost. Again, the realisation when you get to a certain age that grown-ups aren't a real thing, that they're us and they're as clueless as everyone else. Like, you kind of as a kid think, oh, our parents understand everything, and then you get to a certain age and go, so when is there going to be a click that I suddenly understand how to exist? So, yeah. It's a bizarre thing. So, but how was that then? We need to talk about your wife and children at that point. How did this all come about? Was the therapy something that made you more open to such things, or was it just out of the blue?
I think looking back on interviews that I did in the 70s, I had always been potentially bisexual.
Yeah.
So, you know, not very bisexual. I've never been very bisexual, to be honest. If I see 100 attractive women, one after the other, it'll be number 98 that I fancy.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, we'll fancy, like, madly.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's quite a low number. Whereas, I like men.
I can imagine that. It will be a low number, but the intensity will be that much higher because it's... has to be to break that norm.
Exactly, you know, so. I mean, exactly, you know? So. Whereas men, I like men.
Yeah.
Men are fabulous. They're just wonderful, you know. Yeah. Even with no sexual interest in them, I just think men are so interesting, so attractive. They do such great things. Men get a bad press, you know.
Yeah, they do.
We get a bad press as a species. And I think men are endlessly fascinating, endlessly interesting and attractive. And I love meeting new people. So, on the whole, if I'm going to be attracted to somebody, it's probably going to be somebody male.
Odds on, you know, it's going to be a guy.
And in terms of the, you know, love affairs that I've had over the years, there's only been like two with women ever. And the one that was the one, could have been a man, could have been a woman, turned out to be a woman.
Yeah.
But it's as simple as that.
Yeah.
So,
and
I don't think...
It's beautiful that it is as simple as that, and it can be as simple as that. It doesn't have to be this complex. So why was it... It was just a woman. That was the one that I met. That was the one that I was drawn to in this moment, you know?
And when you meet the person you want to spend the rest of your life with, A, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
That's the person I want to spend the rest of my life with. And B, you can't worry about the technicalities of, is this the right gender?
Is
this appropriate? The hell with all that. What are people going to think? I don't care what people think.
Yeah.
I've met the person for me.
It's the beautiful thing of, if there is ever a time where a sexuality is a removed label, then that's far more... Yeah, it'd be a wonderful thing to not have that. Because, again, there will be thousands upon thousands of people on a daily basis who are fighting an internal battle because of that, because they're suddenly going, shit, I've just met, I think I've met the person I want to spend the rest of my life with, but they're of the same sex, or again, they're of the opposite sex, and I thought they were meant to be, you know. It's so ridiculous to have that unnecessary conflict thrown in there.
The other thing about being gay is it's so much more than who you sleep with.
Yeah.
There's a whole gay mindset, there's a gay lifestyle, a gay approach to life. You know, most of the people that I've socialised with up to that point, and long after that point, have been gay.
Yeah. I mean, it's fascinating you said that you met your wife at... Was it
a gay
switchboard benefit? Yeah. So again, I'd imagine neither of you were expecting to meet your future.
No. And in fact,
in that manner,
there was actually quite a big gap.
Yeah.
Between us first meeting and us becoming an item.
Yeah.
You know. So we were just in the same group of friends for a while, and suddenly, forest fire kind of caught on and. So about 3 years after first meeting, it really took off. And the thing was, I didn't want to be a hypocrite and sing Glad to Be Gay on stage each night and then go home to my female partner as a dirty little secret.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I'd imagine particularly after the being called out in the past for your Mockney accent or anything like that, to suddenly feel that another huge part of your sound and your identity could in any way be perceived to be fake and inaccurate, right?
Absolutely so. You know, people used to speculate about the wife and kids 10 years before I even remotely had any chance of having either.
Yeah.
If Tom Robinson's wife hadn't existed, it would have been necessary to invent her in the tittle-tattle.
Yeah.
So... Actually, where were we?
You'd met and you'd had to come to terms with this, and then come out as not out.
I was here we go. I was going to say, I didn't want I didn't want to be singing Glad to Be Gay on stage every night and then going home secretly to my female partner like it was a dirty little secret. So I did an interview with Capital Gay and I did an interview with the Pink Paper, in which, in the course of which, I said, oh, by the way, I'm living with a woman at the moment. And the journalist went, you know, well, why are you telling me this? So what? Big deal. You know, we all have flings. You know, more things in heaven and earth. So it wasn't a big deal for either of those papers, both of them reported it. But then, 12 months later, the Sunday People found out. And for them, it was a big deal.
Yeah, it was huge.
They called my manager and said, we want to do an interview with Tom about his sexuality. And the manager said, fuck off. So they then came to my house and rang the doorbell and shouted through the letterbox, Tom, we want to interview you about your sexuality. I said, fuck off. They waited behind a dustbin until my partner arrived home from work and leapt out and snapped a picture of her in her crash helmet and said, well, can we interview you about your sexuality? And she said, fuck off. So they tracked my dad down.
Got the party line down.
They tracked down my dad in holiday in France and said, can we interview you about your son's sexuality? He told them to fuck off. So that Sunday, I was in the newsagents and I saw a copy of the Sunday People. And it actually had on the front, inside, exclusive with Tom Robinson. I went, what? So I had to buy a copy. I mean, it went against the grain, but I did have to buy a copy. And there was a centre page colour spread. And the headline, I kid you not, said, Britain's number one gay in love with girl biker, My Passion for Blonde by Rocker Robinson. And they'd made the whole thing up.
Yeah, I mean,
they made up the quotes. A friend says, Tom's so glad not to be gay anymore. He's so much happier now. Yeah. He says he's really in love with Sue.
Was there a sense of pride of being declared Britain's number one gay?
Well,
in that moment of shock, going, well, actually, it still is. It's nice to be number one, you know.
Do you know, the thing I wished reading that was, I wished that somebody else had told all the other gays that I was number one.
I wish this had been announced a few years back.
Yeah, really. That would have, in the context,
I could have reaped the benefits.
But I suppose it was the shortest tabloidese shorthand they could use to say somebody famously homosexual is having this affair.
Wow.
And all they knew about Sue was that she was a motorcyclist. So
she had a bike helmet when they tried to get her.
Biker. So, then that became a whole thing once they get their hooks into you. And
how was that? Because was that at a point you'd stepped away from music at this point anyway, right? Or was...
No, am I getting not the... really. This is late 80s.
Yeah,
so, I was still struggling away.
Yeah.
But I had no idea that I was still a tabloid-worthy story at that time.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It was a long time since the last hit. That caused quite a lot of ill feeling. And then when our first child was born, they again got hold of the story and said, we want to come and take pictures of your baby. And we said, are you crazy? Yeah. No. And they said, well, we've got a story about you you're not going to like, and we're going to run it this Sunday unless you let us come and take pictures of your baby. We went to a PR expert and said, look, what can we do about this? And they said, there's nothing you can do. Until they've published, you can't sue them for anything. And they'll be careful enough not to say anything that's actually actively untrue. They'll say, a friend said, and you won't be able to prove that a friend didn't say it.
Yeah.
The only thing you can do is take your own baby pictures and go public with it the day before they're due to publish.
Yeah.
And spike the story. So there's a complete non-story for the Sunday People.
Yeah.
And so we did. We Jill Firmanovsky, bless her, who's taken the pictures for the new album, came and took pictures of me and my wife and the baby, and we wrote a press release and put it out there, and they all ran with it. The Sun ran with it, the Mirror ran with it, you know, inevitable Glad to Be Dad headlines, but broadly sympathetic, saying...
Again, I guess that's just, it's taking that control back, and again, and removing any shame, again, any fear you had initially of coming out as having a female partner now, and them going, oh yeah, okay. So it's that thing of actively going out and going, this is beautiful.
Well, because there were beautiful photos.
This is a good thing. This isn't something I want to be scared about or nervous about or worried about. This is something I want to celebrate, you know?
We didn't have a choice, of course.
Yeah, and, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
And all our gay friends were going, why are you talking to the Sun? Of yeah, all of the papers, yeah, 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 all the things they've written about AIDS in the last yeah. 5 years, why
yeah.
are you giving the Sun exclusive pictures of your baby?
Yeah, that must have been
tough. What are you dreaming of, you know? And, of course, we had no platform with which to reply to that.
Yeah.
So there we were, suddenly, it seemed, sending out press releases and photos and boasting about
yeah.
the changed sexuality, the
when it was
domestic,
very
at the
much
height
a,
of yeah. the AIDS crisis. So
yeah, yeah, I guess so. And not, again, there's not, the full story isn't there. I can completely understand the reaction of the gay scene there. I can also knowing that this was a reaction to basically threats and blackmail, understand what you guys had to do for the sake of your family.
We had to do it. Ever since then, I mean, we've never mentioned any of the family by name.
Yeah.
Never published any photos of any of the family
yeah.
publicly on any social media. You know, yeah. my wife has an Instagram account, but she never does selfies on it.
Yeah, yeah.
And if she's in one of my pictures, I always crop it so she's not
yeah.
not in there, because you just want to preserve.
Just take that privacy back.
Take that privacy back. And my kids never asked to be famous.
Yeah.
Or to be written about or to be yeah. talked about. So we've done our damnedest to keep their lives private and
yeah.
their profiles private, and you know what they do now they're grown up, that's
yeah yeah
that's their business,
that's completely on them,
but they've got that choice
again. It's their own choice there. Yeah, well, I mean, we're going on and on, this is becoming a wonderful bumper edition, but we do need to talk about radio because
yeah.
it's such a key part. You're one of, I'd imagine, very few people to have worked on every BBC station, right? You've gone on 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, you know, all yeah. the way through. So how did you decide that broadcasting was your calling, when you decided very much that despite the offers from labels or whatever, that you needed to walk away from music?
Well, the two ran side by side for a fair while. In the mid-80s, a BBC World Service producer came to see me play a show, and she liked the bits between the songs
yeah, yeah.
more than the songs.
Yeah.
And she thought, that's a great voice for radio. So she approached me and said, would you like your own little series on the BBC World Service? So I had this series called New Waves on the Shortwave, just 15-minute shows once a week, where I'd play some new records
yeah.
each week. So, having done that, I got offered a gig depping for Janice Long on Radio 1.
Right.
While she was first in Japan, and then when she took maternity leave.
Yeah.
So I did a bit of depping on Radio 1. That was an eye-opener.
You yeah. know,
being on the other side of the world, suddenly finding that at Radio 1, the producers ran the show.
Yeah.
The music wasn't chosen by the DJs, it was chosen by the producers.
Yeah, again, the huge power of the unnamed people essentially behind the scenes there is,
yeah.
particularly in daytime. I mean, I'd say not so much the later you get into the evening, and it's why people like John Peel were rightfully John Peel.
Yeah.
But yeah, particularly in the daytime element, how much of that is by producer and committee, essentially, rather than the voice you're hearing presenting these things.
Exactly so. So then, early 90s, I then started getting work on Radio 4,
yeah.
Pick of the Week, things yeah. like that. And then I got my own series on Radio 4 called The Locker Room, which was about the one thing that I was really, really interested in, men.
Yeah.
So it was a kind of men's answer to woman's hour.
And, brilliant.
And they've got the men's room now on 5 Live, but it's not the same
no.
kind of approach. It was a magazine programme on a good slot too. It was like on early on a Saturday evening,
yeah.
Once a week. And discussions, little... It, interview pieces, opinion pieces. We had Jarvis Cocker, we had Will Self doing kind of
brilliant
little essays and things in there, and tried to take a take on it that was both kind of humorous and deft and light in touch, but also dealing with things like being a sperm donor or impotence or female on male violence, which is an aspect of domestic violence that just doesn't get discussed.
Hugely uncovered and and people, hugely undiscussed.
And the shaming for the men concerned who've been beaten up by female partners.
The lack of respect it gets is something I was discussing on Twitter the other day. It's always struck me as bizarre, the John Wayne Bobbitt story, how that, I remember at school, that was a hilarious story. And even now in the media, I was watching a history of the 90s or something thing the other day, and there was kind of laughing at it. And my argument is always, if that was a man who found out his wife was cheating and he cut off her genitalia and threw it out the window of a... It's like, that would be one of the most haunting and tragic and disgusting stories imaginable. But because it was female on male, it was seen as oh, there you go. And it was kind of this big ongoing joke, and TV shows and were talking about it and find this hilarious thing. And it's that's a domestic violence story essentially, and it's hilarious. So it only goes to show how the smaller the less famous domestic violence situations are obviously not going to be taken as seriously and given as much attention than they clearly should.
I think, you know, both of us would want to mark here the fact that male-on-female domestic violence is such a horrific and horrifically widespread thing that, you know, rightfully that gets talked about and probably still needs to be talked about more even now. And it's absolutely unacceptable.
Again, I'm a huge... There's certain things I believe that get lost in the equality debate, and obviously I'm hugely in favour of equality, but there's still the fact that men and women are different physically and genetically. There is a difference. So, completely right that... The heightened physical risk, I guess, of male on female domestic violence, it justifies it getting as much attention as possible. But that it's that stupid thing, and we had this a lot when Caitlyn Jenner appeared recently, gloriously to much press, and there was a lot of people saying, when everyone was saying how brave she is, they're saying, well, our soldiers are brave. So that doesn't mean that she's not, though. There doesn't have to be this competition of, well, it should be either a female on male or male on female that gets the attention. If you know what I mean, one might deserve more, but that doesn't mean that they should be ignored. I don't want to see more. I don't want to see stories of bravery of soldiers instead of stories of Caitlin's bravery. I want to hear both. Yeah. Let's have both. I want to have time for both of them. I don't. It doesn't have to be one or the other, or a competition for who's the most brave or what is the most worthy cause. There's a lot of worthy causes. So yeah, definitely on that.
Totally. So that was The Locker Room.
Yeah.
You know, covering a wide variety. So it ran for 6 series into the 90s. I started getting documentary gigs where I'd be kind of writing and compiling a documentary about a particular subject. So that's when I went and did the Gay Games.
I was going to say, in 97, wasn't it, you won a Sony Award for one of your documentaries. And again, it was a great moment to have that voice, to be able to speak out.
And that was the You've Got to Hide Your Love Away, which was taken after the John Lennon song
that moved me
back in the day. It was a history of gay music up to David Bowie, basically, and it was on GLR, as it then was, BBC London, as it now is. So that was a great landmark moment in 97, to have my hand shaken by the Director General of the BBC for making a programme about gay music.
Yeah.
20 years after the BBC
had
banned my gay songs.
Amazing.
So that was a really
amazing,
sweet,
yeah,
nice moment.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So bit by bit, over the years, I've been offered programmes on different stations. I've did a series of documentaries for Radio 3 where we were looking at icons. So famous classical musicians would then tell me about the classical musicians they considered iconic in their performances. Right. And I was, although I know next to nothing about classical music, my ignorance was my chief weapon.
Yeah.
So I'd say, look, I don't understand why opera singers do this wobbly vibrato thing, but what makes a really great opera singer versus just an ordinary one?
Yeah.
Can you explain to me this difference? Why this person you've chosen is so brilliant? And then they'd illustrate it with clips of music.
It's great. It's what Louis Theroux does so well. It's what I like doing on here, and I always refer to it as playing the Alan Davis role of on QI. They all joke at Alan being the idiot. Alan's incredibly intelligent, but he plays the role of the rest of us sitting at home who might not be on the same level as Stephen Fry and John Sargent and all these other people. So he gets to be the one that makes them explain it to the layman. And again, that's great. That's what you need at points. It helps everyone along. Rather than everyone having this conversation above everyone else, it brings everyone into it. It goes, here's why they do that with their voices, and here's what makes them good.
Exactly. And I think now we get into the noughties. You get the tragic death of John Peel in 2004. And as well as all the work that we know him for with music, he did have this show on Saturday mornings on Radio 4, Home Truths, which very heavily divided people. People like John Walters hated it, considered it too folksy. Other people, it was compulsive listening every week. And for me, I was one of the compulsive listeners. Yeah. I loved the programme. I loved its format. I loved the interviewing of ordinary people about their ordinary lives and things that had happened to them, which are fascinating. Yeah. People used to draw these stories out of people so brilliantly. And I was a contributor to Home Truths, doing little essay pieces from here and there.
Yeah.
And after he died, I had the privilege of being one of the team of replacement presenters who stepped in to present that show while it lasted. I did 12 episodes of Home Truths as presenter, and it was endlessly interesting. I loved doing that. And then the culmination of it was a year on from John's death that Home Truths did a special from Peel Acres where I went back with the producer and met the family, talked to them about what John had been like, saw around the record collection.
Wow. Yeah.
And we did a one-hour special, and it was done by BBC Audio, did it actually as a...
That's amazing.
As a special CD that you can
get. That must have meant the world to get to do that, huge
privilege.
Yeah.
You know. And then later, when I had my shows on Six Music, I actually asked Tom Ravenscroft to come and do a guest hosting show with his brother Will. We got them to curate a show for us, which was really interesting, getting the kind of Peel juniors. But then, of course, Tom's was already on his way to being a considerable broadcaster in his own right. Then when I had to go on holiday, he sat in on my show, and those were the first shows he did for Six Music. So I'm really pleased that I helped at least sow the seed in the minds of management that Tom would be a good broadcaster for this station, because he's just one of the main assets now.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, so let's talk about the importance of Six Music at the moment, with the way so much is changing. There's a lot of talk, obviously, of the changes at XFM recently and it becoming this male-dominated station. And, you know, there's so much... Radio 1... love it or hate it, has to be ever evolving. So many people will go, oh, I can't listen to Radio 1 now, it's gone all this genre or that genre. It's like, that normally tells a lot about your birth certificate. It normally says you've got to a certain age where the music has changed. You now have to move on to another genre, whereas Six seems to just have that broadness in embracing all types of music and all types of shows. And I genuinely feel when there was the campaign to save Six Music, that felt like a massive turnaround for it. It seemed to I mean, I know it wasn't, but that could have been the best marketing ploy ever. Because I think it made so many more people aware of Six Music. Because those who listened fought so passionately to save it, it made so many more people go, I should give this a look and pay attention. And more people who previously listened but didn't always listen suddenly kind of have sat up and got involved.
It was even more important than that because management didn't know what they got.
Yeah, yeah.
Up until the attempt to close it, management had been trying putting comedians on hosting shows, people like George Lamb coming in to do the morning show in the hope of broadening our demographic and increasing its appeal, completely missing the reason Six Music existed. They thought Gideon Coe, who did the mid-morning show brilliantly, you know, was a bit of an embarrassment because he knew too much about music.
Yeah.
And the thinking was somehow we need somebody more populist, less blokey, less train spottery in their musical knowledge. They thought the Freak Zone was something that needed to be shunted off into the middle of the night because who wants to hear these obscure records from the 60s?
Yeah.
They found out through the listeners in that campaign to save the station, Stuart McConey wasn't the most embarrassing thing about Six Music. He was the crown fucking jewels.
Yeah.
Stuart McConey is now on air 7 days a week on Six Music. He's done the Rad Mac show all through the week in the prime slot in the afternoons. Yeah. And then he's got the Freak Zone and the Freakier Zone. Because that is what makes Six Music great, is that specialist knowledge, that mad, passionate enthusiasm for peculiar music that's driven by Stuart.
It's for me, it's paralleled by John Kennedy at XFM. And again, I was so happy when they've had these reshakes that he doesn't appear to be going anywhere. Because again, there's only one John Kennedy, and that was the thing with Six Music, was realizing that you don't need to broaden it to be more like Radio 1 or more like Capital or whatever else. The point is, everyone else is trying to be so similar. What makes Six Music is that it's the home for everyone that isn't into that. And maybe there are millions more who want to listen to Chris Moyles or whoever else on Radio 1, on X or wherever else. But that's not everyone. It's never going to be everyone. There's always going to be a certain amount of people who really don't want that, who really, really do not want to listen to that. Therefore, you can then build a good audience by making a home for all of those people in Six, essentially, now.
Yeah, and basically since 2010, management now realise what it is that we've got, and we've got the mission statement about, you know, the spirit of alternative music down the decades. Which is what informs it. So, thank goodness. I mean, it was the saving of it, but it was the saving of it because it became something new once the listeners had explained to us what we had and shown where the priorities lay.
And so, I feel we do need to run off a bit of a list of Lauren Laverne, of Sean Keaveney, of Huey Morgan, of Guy Garvey, of so
Steve
many
Lamack.
Steve Lamack, the legendary, of so many people that. Imagine if they weren't on the radio. Imagine how tragic this would be, knowing the variation of the shows that they present. It's
Keris Matthews. I'm
100%. Yeah. It's amazing. We should probably talk about your new record at some point, Tom. That should probably come up. What has drawn you back? Again, it feels beautiful because we've had this whole journey now where you've walked away from music, you've transitioned prior to your walking away into radio, and then becomes such a staple and master of the format. So what could possibly draw you back to putting out music and having to be reviewed again, which incidentally 8 out of 10 in Uncut, 4 out of 5 in Mojo, the new record seems to be being received very, very well. So what has drawn you back? How nervous were you, and how much did things like that, those early reviews kind of calm you and make you go, right, God, I'm not going to have to go off to Germany and disappear?
Well, my big problem really is that since I've been at Six, I was on the founding team at Six, so that I was over in the research department when it was called Network Y.
Wow.
And we were trying out different ideas and different playlists and seeing how it could work. So I was there day one when the boss of Radio 2 walked in, Jim Moyer, and said, we've got it. We've been given the go-ahead. We've got the green light.
Yeah.
And I've been here ever since. And in that time, my musical tastes have changed so much. Yeah. You know, from the music I grew up with in the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, into the noughties, suddenly sitting there as a consumer, it's like having been a chef and suddenly getting a gig as a restaurant critic.
So suddenly,
instead of just thinking about my own kitchen and ingredients,
your own speciality.
Yeah, what I can cook up for my small, loyal band of customers. I'm eating at the very best restaurants, interviewing Tom York, Bob Geldof, Paul McCartney, the people who are like specialists in what they... Brian Eno! I got 4 hours with Brian Eno. I can't believe
it. It's insane.
You know, to find out what makes him tick and how it all goes. Being in that position as a consumer broadens your tastes and refines your palate so much. So you go, I don't want to listen to that same old blooming blues 12-bar nonsense that I used to get off in the 60s today, rehashed without anything new added. I actually want to listen to music that makes me sit up and take notice and shocks me, surprises me, that makes me feel alive. And the trouble is, I only know how to make the old kind of music when I pick up a guitar, C, F and G fall under my fingers. So there was this huge gap that had been building up between the songs I had on a back burner that I knew were valid for me and an expression, but I didn't want to listen to them in that form. And I certainly didn't want to offer them to anyone else to listen to in that form, because in a way, the noise that I made bored me. So it was meeting the right producer. When I met Jerry Diver, first becoming a fan of Jerry Diver.
Yeah.
So I heard the work that he did on Sam Lee's A Ground of Its Own.
Yeah.
Amazing production on that folk record that made it sound so fresh and contemporary, even though it was centuries old folk was its origins. Because of that, I then heard Jerry Diver's Speech Project, where he took spoken word interviews with famous Irish folk musicians and then took the melodies of the voices in the interviews, turned them into tunes, and then vocalised those with violins.
That's amazing. And
it's an amazing album, Jerry Diver's Speech Project. I can very warmly recommend that. So I was a huge fan of that, had him as a guest on the show, and then I started hearing all these other records that he produced, A Hooli and Tido. The Misshaped Pearls album. His wife turns out to be Lisa Knapp, the folk singer, who I'd already had on the show. And he'd produced that album as well. So I was a huge fan of his production, but it was all within a certain genre, quite folky, quite esoteric, quite Radio 3. But then last year at the English Folk Expo, I saw Jerry perform with Lisa, and he had that kind of primal punk energy to the way he played the violin and the way he attacked the keyboards that made me think, bloody hell, this bloke is amazing. When Jerry Diver plays a violin, it doesn't sound like a violin. It sounds like a chainsaw. It sounds like a cloud of wasps. It sounds like anything except the traditional jigs and reels kind of Irish folky fiddle, even though that's his expertise and background.
Yeah, of course.
I spoke to him on Twitter a day later, and he just said, well, if you ever think of making another record, Tom, do get in touch. And I just replied, I thought you'd never ask.
Yeah.
And we went into the studio not knowing what was going to happen, because I thought I was going to end up with a bit of a folky, kind of esoteric Radio 3-ish kind of album. And he's like an animal. He's like a monster when he gets in there behind his technology. Let him loose with a drum kit. I think this is the first record he produced with a full-blown drum kit. And we've got Andy Treacy, the drummer from Faithless, who's playing on it. Yeah. So great grooves, great rhythms. But Jerry's own special treatment on it.
Yeah.
And
I'm just imagining that there's this amazing guy who's been producing all this more folksy stuff, but just gagging to have the reins taken off, that suddenly you've come in and gone, well, how about we try this? He's like, oh, again, I thought you'd never ask. Kind of returning the response to you.
Pip, it all came from him.
Yeah.
To be honest, I have this song about smoking the Bible.
Yeah.
based on a story I was told about these boys living on a farm in rural Wales, completely broke. And when they ran out of money and Rizzlers, they used to pull pages out of a family Bible and skin up with them.
Yeah.
And took this to Jerry as a reformed ex-Catholic, loved the idea. And he said, you know, I'm hearing chiptune on this, sort of 8-bit, really. Do you like Prodigy? And so I was going, well, do what you want. Yeah. And he programmed up this bizarre electro backing for it. And then he went, we need the voice of God on this. We need to hear from God. Do you know Stephen Fry? And I went, well, not really, but I do know Ian McKellen. And he went, that'd be great. So we got Ian McKellen to come in and be God.
Amazing.
And then we wanted an alternative voice, like condemning this idea, so that we didn't have it all the way of the stoners, but somebody coming in and saying, look, you know, you shouldn't be smoking the Bible, this is all wrong. And Swami Barakas came on and did this brilliant kind of, from the Hindu point of view, are you completely crazy? Step outside this purple haze. Harry Secombs in his grave, and you're blazing on these songs of praise. Man, I'm in disgust. That's Exodus, not angel dust. You know,
and amazing. His
brilliant line in it: "You're never going to catch me turning the Gita to a reefer."
Perfect.
So
perfect.
There's him and Ian McKellen and all this chiptune stuff. You wouldn't expect that from a folk producer in a million years.
That's amazing.
So, we had huge fun with it. And then, to top it all, Jerry's come on the road with us, and he's joined the band.
Oh, wow.
On electric violin and keyboards. And he's just bringing that same primal
amazing.
Energy to
so
the band.
So how exciting is it to be getting on the road again in that manner? You know, not just the London and Belgian gigs, you know, I once here to be put in a full band together and a different a sound that's new to you and, you know, a new approach in general. How exciting is that after all this time?
Totally exciting, because Jerry's brought my music kicking and screaming into the 21st century. Yeah. So he's made me the kind of record that I would play on the radio.
Brilliant, yeah.
As opposed to the kind of record that I know how to make myself.
And the beautiful thing there is you're going to have now a whole fan base who know you as someone off the radio, you know, more than as a musician. But the beautiful fact there is they know your show and the kind of music that you play. So now, regardless of if they were even aware that you did music, you're now going to be playing music that still fits in their realm and in their sphere. So
that's what I'm hoping.
Perfect,
anyway.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing. So when does the album... What's the release date? This is going out on October 21st, I think. So I think the record will have come out last week, right?
Yeah, it came out on Friday the 16th.
Yeah, so out now and available now. How much are you planning on touring it? And
we've got a big 15-day tour in the UK. Also, I'm heading over to Ireland to do a couple of kind of showcase gigs. Of course, showcase gigs in Belgium. to get going there.
So, yeah.
And it's just very exciting to be doing it live. And a complete thrill. I mean, we've done it, the whole thing, you know, is done on my own label, once again, like with War Baby.
Fantastic.
And didn't have any money to make it, so we crowdsourced with Pledge Music.
Yeah.
And bless them, the audience that wanted to hear the album paid for it in advance, enabled us to make the record.
Yeah.
And hit, I think, at the time of recording this, 184% of the target.
Wow.
Which...
That's amazing.
Which means that we could then afford proper... full colour sleeves for it, proper promotion for it. The whole thing has all been ploughed in there. And all the people who pledged and asked for their names are all in prime pole position on the inside of the album.
Brilliant.
Got a list of all their names.
That's beautiful. It's when it's done so independently, it means all the more when you're getting that reception from people like Uncut, from Mojo. Because in all rights, a lot of the time, smaller labels are going to be ignored by them. So that must just, must mean the world, right?
It certainly does. I'm, you know, thrilled. And, you know, it's a great honour to be invited onto Distraction Pieces as well, because, you know, the list of illustrious guests that you've had now is wonderful.
It's just
company.
It's
to
great
be in.
Fun that it just keeps going and going. And as I said, I tweeted, we've recorded this a month ahead, so I've mysteriously tweeted on the way here that I've got a feeling that I'm on the way to record one of my favourite ones, and it definitely has been. So I think this is the perfect time to to wrap things up. So again, where can people keep up to date on everything, on the tour, on the record, everything else, on Twitter, on the website?
TomRobinson.com. It couldn't be simpler.
Perfect. It couldn't be simpler. That's perfect. Well, thank you very much for coming on.
Pip, a huge pleasure. Great honour. And have to have you on the radio show.
Yes, 100%. Always, always happy to come on that. So yeah, thank you very much.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go, man. We've all just been on a journey, you know. That was with some stuff, some shit's happened there. You know, we started this together 3 hours ago, possibly more than three hours ago. And yeah, man, that dude's an amazing guy. If he's listened, I doubt he will. He was there, but big love to Tom Robinson. What a dude! Amazing radio show, amazing human, amazing a musician, just generally top guy. But how open and such a story to tell. Thank you for tuning in. We've got a lot of guests on their way. We've got a Carla coming. I'm lining up Adam Buxton. Stephen Graham, me and Jessica Hines keep dancing around each other. We can't seem to put a date together to make that happen, but that will do. Same with Izzy Sooty. I need to get back to her. So yeah, a lot of great guests to come. Thank you for tuning in. If you enjoyed this one on the radio tip, I'd recommend the John Kennedy one, because that was another mind blowing one for me, just hearing his story. So check that out. But there's also Hugh Stevens. There's Rob the Bank. There's Eddie Temple Morris. There's loads. It's Billy Bragg. I mean, we talk about Billy Bragg on the podcast. He's done Distraction Pieces. So check that out. Thank you for tuning in, guys. Please subscribe. Please rate and review and all that kind of thing. Podcasts are blowing up, eh? It's dope, and I always encourage it. But there's suddenly a lot more competition, and there's a lot of big companies and big, industries and big people stepping into the podcast game. So I want to let you know that I appreciate all of you that continue to support this small independent podcast and keep climbing us up the charts and spreading with a word of mouth and love and downloads and subscriptions and all that good stuff. Thank you very, very much for supporting. Oh, damn. This will be the last one before the live show, right? If I've done my maths right, I've recorded these a bit in advance. Yes. So if you listen to this on the day it comes out, on Saturday, I've got my club night at the book club, We Are Lizards. It's our last one of the year. So basically, We Are Lizards is the one day each month I drink. I mean, it's a good club night as well. I play good music. We've got amazing DJs. Push Music is one of the best DJs out there. We've got DJ Destruction. He's awesome. Stu DJs sometimes as well. But yeah, we go there and we play music. But it's my one night of drinking and hanging out with you guys. So I generally get a bit on it, and I generally hang out with you guys and have a good chat, and we have fun, and it's lovely. But then, even more excitingly, on Monday is the first ever, the one-off, probably, maybe, possibly, but definitely the first ever live Distraction Pieces podcast. It might have sold out by now. It was close to selling out a few weeks ago, but these things can come in waves, so you never know. But come along to that if you can get a ticket. It's at the Leicester Square Theatre. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be the first ever live Distraction Pieces podcast. I'm very excited about it, and I'm amazed that I get to do it in such a revered location. So, yeah, thanks for tuning in, guys. I'll see you all next week. This has been the Distraction Pieces podcast. You can follow on Twitter at Scroobius Pipio or at DistractionCast on Facebook, facebook.com/ScroobiusPip or facebook.com/DistractionPiecesPodcast. And shout out to the guys who run the Facebook page and Twitter and the YouTube page, because they're killing it. They're regularly putting up these short clips that are shareable, enjoyable, kind of highlights from individual episodes. So there might be episodes
you love, but you don't particularly want to go back and listen to 90 minutes of. So you can go and find these snippets, enjoy them, share them on your Facebook page, share them on Twitter, share them wherever you wish. So, yeah, thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you all next week. Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.